Good evening, James McCanney, May 28th, 2009, with my Science Hour, going right into the show. And this week, I spent the week with about 15,000 of my good friends at a science conference. These I go to regularly to present my science material. What you hear on the radio is presented in a more technical level. These are scientists who come from all over the world and meet to discuss everything from rocks and geology to planetary space science to volcanism to ancient atmospheres of the planets to solar physics and everything in between. And of course, what I was presenting on dealt with Earth weather, the actual topic I'm talking about tonight. So you get a good taste of exactly what I have been doing this past week, presenting my material at I just have a few quick announcements. Memorial Day this past week, I just have a question regarding Memorial Day, and my dad was a World War II vet. You know, that was the generation that really did some hard work, let's put it that way. And a lot of things are coming out to tell us now that much of the wars in the past were constructed, fabricated, and not really necessary that they were. But anyway, that's not the point. The question I have, and this is something for the veterans to ponder too, do past wars mean that we should have future wars? And that's too many times the message I hear when the politicians honor the war heroes. And there should be two parts of this. My dad was told, for example, when he was fighting in World War II, that they were fighting the war to end all wars. Well, of course, they were no more out of World War II when the Korean War started, then it was quickly followed thereafter by the Vietnam War, and on and on, and many wars, some of them undeclared ever since. It's just too darn good for business, if you know what I mean. There's, of course, the huge industry around warfare, and the question, as once again, do past wars mean we have to have future wars? Are the children's children and grandchildren on into the in far distant future destined to have continual war also? Is there a different way to run this planet? Is there a different way to operate the ship? Anyway, the Hubble Space Telescope now is ready for a long-term use in space, and I mentioned this last week. I said, what if something breaks on that? Because NASA cannot get to it anymore. So hopefully that thing will keep working. The only big criticism I have of the Hubble Space Telescope is that it takes a lot of data that we don't see. They always send us the pretty pictures, trying to wow the public with the capability of the Hubble Space Telescope. But what does the public really get out of this? And what kind of science is hidden? For example, the discovery of many Planet X objects that we know are circling and moving around the solar system in elliptical orbits. How many of those have been detected? And as I said last week, there was a new camera that was installed in the Hubble, and it appears that that has some very special capabilities to look for fuzzy objects at the far reaches of our solar system. And of course, NASA is very aware that I'm totally correct about the plasma discharge comet model. And when they see these objects at the far distant reaches of the solar system, they're already discharging the solar capacitor. They already look like a big, fuzzy, nebular gas ball. And it's very difficult to see in there and actually see the nucleus, which is the heart of the comet. And, of course, these are big comets, big, not like Halley's Comet, a little 7-mile-across potato-shaped thing. We're talking major League objects, possibly even the size of Jupiter. But my commendation, and of course, there was a good deal of fanfare over the astronauts who spent 5 days of spacewalk. Now, that's truly amazing. And, of course, I always criticize NASA, but that my hat's off to the astronauts who worked and worked and worked on that Hubble Space Telescope to get it in pristine condition and an absolute 100%, 110% success. And that's the kind of thing I wish we were seeing every day out of NASA, which is one of the other problems. We have a manned lunar program supposedly that's going on where they will have no results for another 15 years. So wouldn't it be great to have this kind of success they had with the Hubble every day in the news? And one more quick story. Young boy, 13 years old, I announced this a couple weeks ago, and then, of course, the major news media picked up on it. And so I didn't continue to announce it, but just if you had not heard, this past Monday, the young boy, 13-year-old, and his mother, through the advice of their attorney, turned themselves in, came back to Minnesota, and the court said, well, the kid can stay with his mother as long as she complies with the court ruling. Obviously, living on the lam was not a good lifestyle, and they saw this going nowhere. As you may have heard, but I'll just fill in the details for you if you had not heard, the FBI had a manhunt out for these two criminals from justice, and they were apparently headed to Mexico, but they had them staked out in Mexico with Interpol, the international police network. So they were pretty much doomed. I think their attorney, whether we agree with it or not, probably gave them sound advice in that they were going to be caught, it was going to destroy their lives, and if they went back, they could at least live a normal life in spite of the chemo. And my guess is this is a very important case for the AMA and the court system because it places the child under state-mandated medication. Now, that's a pretty scary proposition. And so the question is, what was the real intent of the law that they're using to require this kid to take chemotherapy? The real intent of the original law was to protect kids from parents that were negligent, that did not provide for the kids, did not care about the kids, so the court could drag them in and say, you have to provide medical treatment for these kids. That's a good law. How did it get twisted? Well, it got twisted into something where the AMA comes in and says, you people need this medication. It's the one we sell and market and profit by, and you cannot take any other one because we don't recognize it. And, of course, the AMA has never studied any alternative treatments. This, you know, when I was a kid, my uncle and aunt both died from chemotherapy. They didn't die from cancer. They died from chemo. And maybe they would have died from cancer eventually, too. But the official designation of death is death by cancer, when that's really not true at all. They died from chemo long before they would have ever died from cancer. So once again, the real issue is what is the true intent of the law? Do people have a right to choose the type of treatment they want and reject the now mandated chemotherapy treatment or other treatments sponsored and marketed by the American Medical Association and then supported by the court system? When did the court become a doctor? And giving medical advice and designating medical advice. But it also brings up another very large question, and it's something that I hope I have time to determine in the future, to spend some time studying this. In the court hearings, the doctors came in with all kinds of statistics, and whenever you see somebody waving the statistics flag, you better start looking a little bit deeper. So isn't it interesting, the AMA and the doctors have all these statistics which tell you that chemo is good and the patients survive. What do they really mean? What tests were done? Were they done by independent laboratories? And there's all kinds of ways to lie about statistics. Let's take an example, a hypothetical example, and say that every time somebody gets chemo, if they don't die, they call it a success. Now, that means that somebody could get chemo 10 times and the AMA statistics would rack up 10 successes. Is that what the statistics are saying? So once again, my question, what do those statistics really mean? And that's where I'm going to start looking into this, because I taught statistics at the university level. It's something I know quite a bit about, and I know also that you can lie with statistics. There was a book back in the, I think it was the 1970s. It was titled, I believe, How to Lie with Statistics. And it just gave all kinds of examples how people would twist information and then claim that statistics supported their claims. And somehow deep inside, I have the feeling that the AMA is in that ballpark, because once again, it's just too darn profitable a business. And of course, if they can require people to have this kind of treatment, then they have a monopoly. What's a monopoly? That's a guaranteed business where the court system says patient A has to take your treatment. Something basically wrong there. There's something inherently wrong with that when the company or the association, whatever, that is profiting is allowed to bring in their own statistics and claim a profit from it. And there's no third-party verification. It's kind of like NASA saying it went to the moon. Maybe they did, but there's no third-party verification. And so that's where it falls down. At any rate, on to the main science topic, which is the... I'll just continue. And this week I want to bring in a lot more topics. Last week I talked about, and I hope you go back and listen to last week's show, and for a lot of people, sometimes this is boring. When I'm talking about the solar wind and electrical charging and the solar capacitor. And the reason I do this is to give you a good feeling for how the solar system works and ultimately our weather, Earth weather. And so I know it's a bit boring, but once again, where else are you going to get information like this on any place on the planet? If you listen to mainstream science, they give you the same washed-down news, and it really doesn't explain to you because the basic theories they're working with are totally incorrect. But let's take just a couple points out of this list that I made up here, and I'll talk about them individually. And what does this have to do with you as a person on Earth? For example, comets are not dirty snowballs, or comets are a complex plasma discharge of the solar capacitor, or the majority of electrical current in the comet is in the form of an electron stream. Well, these all have the same analogies in Earth weather. The Earth itself is not a snowball, yet we have interactions with the solar wind that are exactly the same as a comet when it's interacting with the solar wind. It's just that a comet is more intense because it's in an elliptical orbit. These are very complex topics. Even for scientists, for trained scientists, they have a hard time grasping these ideas. The bigger problem with the scientists, however, is that they have mental doors and mental blocks which block their ability to look in these directions, but they're slowly changing because they're starting to discover this themselves, piece by piece. I don't know how many conferences and discussions I went to this past week with the meetings I went to, and where I listened to scientists taking one little piece of the puzzle, and they're going, look at these electric fields, and electric field, and this electric field, and the resulting magnetic field. 5 years ago, only 5 years ago, you would have not have heard this in the same set of conferences. And so that's what the progress is, I would say. Of course, they feign to recognize or reference my work, which was done, you know, 30 years ago, long before any of these people had ever dreamt that there were electric fields in outer space. But be that as it may, let me bring up some other topics here. Comets gain mass and are becoming new members of the solar system. They don't all become planets, but what does that have to do with Earth being very much comet-like? Well, when we discharge the solar capacitor and we have changes in flux in the solar wind, which causes our Earth weather, then we have material that comes in from outer space. Look at the swine flu. I predicted that months in advance. I said the end of March and early April, we would have a bout of swine flu, and that hit right on the nail, because I knew that those swine flu viruses develop in the comet tail of Venus. Venus is a planet, as we think of it today, but it's also very much a comet with a large cometary tail. And once again, this relationship is documented in the medical journals. The Chinese document this going all the way back to the 1200s, where the inferior conjunction of Venus, that's when Venus moves between us and the sun, is coincident with the swine flu on Earth. And that's why you get a different variety just about every time, because you're going through a different portion of the tail of Venus. And this time it was very much exaggerated because of a comet Lulin, which was very much connecting electrically with Venus, and I could predict that we would go through a very different part of the tail, the comet tail of Venus. And so therefore, we were going to get a very different strain of flu this year, which we did. So it, at any rate, so what does the statement that comets are drawing in material from the solar system, what does that have to do with planet Earth? Well, it has a lot. The viral structures come in from outer space. How about water? When we have a low pressure cell on Earth, let's talk about just the average storm system that moves across the Midwestern states or the outback of Australia or across the mountainous region of New Zealand or the vast central plains of Russia, the steppes, China, India. Whenever you have a tremendous storm system, Central Africa, there many times the water or some of the water in those storm systems is actually coming in from outer space. Scientists have measured this. They've actually measured the water coming in, and they're somewhat befuddled by the presence of water in the upper atmosphere. And it comes in kind of clumps. And at first they thought maybe there were little ice balls coming in and disintegrating, but they didn't follow the pattern. They were kind of like broad regions of the upper atmosphere that exhibited a water spectrum. And so they knew that the water was there. They had no idea where it was coming from or why. But there again, if you understand that Earth is like a plasma discharge comet, then the water is coming in from outside and becoming part of our weather systems. So all of this is related. All of it is related. When you go back to the ancient Maya, they talk about Quetzalcoatl, the plume serpent god of the night sky, which was at the time Venus the comet, which was moving through the solar system before it became a planet. And they were very much influenced by this because we went through the tail, the very large, gigantic tail, when Venus was an extremely large comet. Now Venus is in a circular orbit, and its comet tail is very faint, almost indetectable. The only reason we know it's there is because we interact with it when Venus comes around between us and the Sun during the inferior conjunction, which, by the way, happened last March, March 27th. All of these issues with planetary weather are related to the same properties that comets exhibit, and so the plasma discharge comet model relates to planets. All of the planets have what they term magnetic tails, but they're really not magnetic tails. These are plasma tails related to the overall electrical discharge of the solar capacitor, and material comes into this tail region and is drawn down into Earth. Scientists this past week, I went to many meetings, scientists are still mistakenly thinking that somehow magnetic fields do this. And the magnetic fields are simply secondary effects of the primary cause, which is the electric fields, or the electric fields and the electrical discharges that are occurring. The magnetic fields are just secondary measurables, and that's what scientists have started out looking for. So at any rate, the issue with trying to talk about comets and the solar wind, what I'm trying to do is relate this to something that means something to you. Let's talk about hurricanes. When you see that hurricane with the eye forming and the big clouds, sometimes hundreds of miles wide, 300-400 miles across at the base of a hurricane, you're seeing the visible portion that's down basically near the surface of the ocean. But what you don't see is that electrical connection that goes up through the ionosphere all the way out into outer space, where the Earth is literally connecting to a comet tail-like structure, an electrical structure in outer space, that's powering that hurricane. And then that is ultimately driven by the solar wind, the solar capacitor. All of these electrical conditions are related, but you can ultimately bring all of them back to one condition in the solar system, and that is the solar capacitor. Now, so that's why last week, and I know, like I say, it was probably rather boring. I hope you go listen to it again and just get a cup of coffee so you stay awake while you're listening to it. But understand that that's very important in understanding our daily weather, especially excessive storm systems, strong storm systems, whether they're thunderstorms, hurricanes, tornadoes, cyclones, typhoons. You name it, the type of storm systems we see on Earth, and then you see these storm systems on other planets, which is very interesting. You see the storm systems on, for example, Jupiter. The Great Red Spot is nothing but a cyclonic storm that goes around and around. And why do cyclones not just go around and around the Earth without ending? Well, they hit land and they electrically short out when they hit land. Once again, an electrical explanation for why hurricanes stop when they hit land. I just about laughed myself off the chair one time. There was a weatherman that came on the Weather Channel, weather.com, and there was a hurricane moving into the Yucatan Peninsula. And he said it was those tremendous mountain ranges in the Yucatan that broke up the hurricane. And I just about laughed myself silly, because there are no mountains in the Yucatan. The Yucatan is one of the flattest places on the planet. The Yucatan Peninsula, I've been all over it, and there might be some minor hills here and there. I wouldn't call them mountains, and it certainly isn't like this major hurricane came in, somehow hit the trees or the mountains and broke up because of like hitting buildings or something. That's so absurd when you look at the level of energy in a hurricane. But that's what these people would say. I mean, absolutely ridiculous, and not having a clue what really causes hurricane, what causes them to move in certain directions, and what causes them to to develop in the first place. What powers the hurricane? Well, it comes from outer space. If we didn't have the electrical connection in the solar system, and this is what I stressed this week in my own presentation at the science meetings, is that if you did not have the electrical conditions in the solar system, you would not have any weather on Earth at all. You'd have some mild, maybe fog-like conditions that would circulate around the planet, but you wouldn't have tornadoes, you wouldn't have hurricanes, you wouldn't have thunderstorms, you wouldn't even have clouds without the vertical electric field. When you see the clouds building in the various layers, all the various different types of clouds, those form because of the vertical electric field. We used to make cloud chambers in physics as experiments, and you needed that electric field to create the fog chamber, or the fog in the chamber, and then we did the high energy physics experiments, of course, watching the particles trace through the hitting the water droplets in the fog that were suspended. But to do that, you needed an electric field. Take another example, snowflakes. Scientists for a very long time tried to create snowflakes in a laboratory. And they tried to get all the atmospheric conditions correct and all of the seed particle in there so that it would build. And all they got were very strange-looking water crystals. Until finally, I don't know if it was by accident or by choice, they put a small electric field at the end of a pinhead, and voila, beautiful snowflakes. And they could make artificial snowflakes just like are made in nature. So what is it up in that upper cloud system that makes snowflakes? So, all of these conditions all come back to the same thing. If we didn't have this differential flow of protons in the solar wind, which creates the solar capacitor, which is the same powering source as comets, if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have snowflakes. Now, this week what I'm trying to do is bring these thoughts together so that now you understand the basic scientific cause for the electric fields in the solar system, etc. But now, how do you apply that? What are the practical applications of that? Let me go through another list here. In fact, this is a list coming from the 2004 anniversary poster, which I hand wrote, this poster. You can buy it on my webpage. But it lists many related items that come from my work. And just to give somewhat of a summary of, as I said, this was a 25-year anniversary from 1979 to 2004, and that's still available. Let me just pick out some items at random here. Galactic formation. It's very interesting when we deal with galactic issues that we are dealing with very large-scale gravitational systems, but also mixed in there are some electrical effects. And by the way, we are not going to move through some imaginary plane of the galaxy in the year 2012, and the Mayas predicted that. That's all a bunch of hooey. I'm not sure how else to say it, but the people making those claims have no scientific background, and there's no scientific basis for thinking we are somehow going to go through a galactic plane, like it's a little piece of paper out there, and one day we're going to pass through it on December 21st, 2012. Just absolutely ridiculous. But let's take another one here. The induced electric dipole redshift, the cause of the redshift in galactic nuclei and quasars. It's a very subtle concept, but in restructuring physics, what I had to do was go back and understand all of the electrical effects, and in fact, it was what Einstein was looking for in his own later years, he wrote a book out of my later years where he comments that the electrical conditions were not understood, the electrical effects and magnetic effects on light. And of course, general relativity deals with gravitational effects on light. And I've gone through this a couple weeks ago. I did a couple lectures just on relativity, general relativity, and the principle of equivalence. But the point is that Einstein was looking for some effect based on electromagnetism, and he never found it. He died before he could complete that, and interestingly enough, that's why he was very interested in Velikovsky's work. That's why they had been good friends, actually, I understand, in Germany before they ever came over to the United States. And then that's one of the reasons Velikovsky ended up at Princeton, where Einstein was also seated. And they had many conversations. And, of course, Einstein was trying to understand that if Velikovsky had stumbled upon something here dealing with electromagnetism, it might give him the key to unlock the door of the electrical effects on light. But Einstein did not live to see that, and in fact, the whole issue of was kind of lost, and scientists never really picked up on that. There's so much political correctness dealing with general relativity that is very much assumed today that it's correct. However, as I said before when I was doing the lectures on general relativity, the principle of equivalence has never been proven. So it's a big assumption in the world of theoretical physics that has never been proven, and for good reason, because it's simply not true. So imagine all the black holes, all of the science, the warped universe, the bending of light around the universe, all of these topics, dark matter, all related to the idea that the universe is somehow warped in space-time. So all kinds of concepts that are probably not true at all, dark matter, dark energy, general relativity, the principle of equivalence, all high probability that none of these have any validity to them at all because of one small item that I came up with called the induced electric dipole redshift, where the redshift actually is a result of electric fields which surround stellar objects. Well, what does that have to do with you? Actually, quite a bit, because once again, comets exhibit redshifts. They shouldn't. Comets are highly charged. That's why they're exhibiting a redshift. And so these are some very subtle issues that once again come back to the issue of comets. And this was very much what Einstein was trying to find. And he was talking to Velikovsky, and of course that never came to fruition. And then the rest of the science community got a hold of Velikovsky and ruined it they never did explore it. They just had a big shooting match and had no intention of ever exploring the possibility. So that electrical effects could do anything in the solar system. So it's actually kind of comical right now to see scientists coming to meetings, talking about electric fields, talking about electric conditions and the driving force in wind systems, etc., where 5 years ago they wouldn't have even done it, and 10 years ago they would have lost their position for saying something like that. So that's very interesting. In fact, I might bring that up at some of these meetings. Let's talk about the ancient civilizations, the Peruvians, the Maya, the Aztecs. All of them had a central deity in their religion related to the giant comets, and they were very specific about that. These represented giant comets, although modern archaeologists don't understand that. And they talk about Quetzalcoatl, and they describe who Quetzalcoatl was. He was causing terrible winds. He would cause flooding. The oceans would raise up on his back and cover the land. Well, what does that mean? In modern archaeology, they talk about that, but they don't give any rational explanation. They just say it because it's obviously what the Mesoamericans were talking about. But they just don't cross that barrier and say, gee, they're talking about comets here. These must have been big comets, and they must have been big comets that really drastically affected Earth. There you come back to Velikovsky and the huge taboo. So I would like to summarize, let me break off here. I would like to summarize the meetings I went to this week, and of course you can't go to all the meetings, so you review some of the abstracts. You go read the posters and other information that people are putting out, and I would say in summary, whether it's geology, meteorology, whether it's volcanism, volcanology, whether it's study of other planetary atmospheres, whether it's solar physics, I don't care what branch of study. And this is, like I say, these are the top scientists, 15,000 approximate number of scientists coming to these international meetings. And I've been coming to these for decades and decades and decades. And repeatedly, and today, the thing I can summarize and say conclusively, they still have no clue what's really going on. For example, imagine, how can you talk about geology when, in fact, the geologists have no clue that there was a major earth-shattering event just a few thousand years ago? How could you do geology and not include that, where mountain ranges changed and the structure of the earth changed, that the pole shifted, that the North Pole and the South Pole that we see today were not there 10,000 years ago, that the glaciation that occurred was the result of us passing through a large comet tail? How can you possibly do geology or climatology or any of the other subjects? How can you do planetary science? How can you go visit Mars? How can you do any of these scientific topics and not have a clue what the major formative events were? And not only did this happen within the past 10,000 years when Venus came through and became a planet, but this has happened dozens and dozens of times in Earth's history. How could you possibly be in any of these major fields and not have a clue? It's kind of like meteorology. I've talked about this many times. It's in my books. How can meteorologists pretend to predict weather? They have computer systems. They have national networks of satellites and modeling capability with computers that's astounding. Yet most of the factors in their computer models have absolutely nothing to do with weather. The reason they are able to predict weather a day or two in advance is because they use interpolations of past weather patterns, and the computer goes through and analyzes past weather patterns and says, this is kind of like this past weather pattern, so this is probably what it's going to do. And they're wrong sometimes, too, because the past weather cannot necessarily predict future weather. And they're getting so they're wrong more and more of the time these days. But the point is that they don't include the real causes for weather, especially severe weather, which are the electrical conditions in the solar system. So isn't it truly amazing that with space science, with everything from planetary geology, earth geology, mineralogy, volcanology, and all of the other branches of science, they don't include the major factors that affect the solar system. They don't include the overall electric field of the solar system as a major driving force, which causes the comets, which causes the earth weather, which causes the water to pour into storm systems from above when we're having tropical storms or torrential thunderstorms or hurricanes or tornadoes. How could you possibly model these when you don't know the major causes and sources of energy. It still amazes me to hear scientists say that energy comes from the surface of the Earth's storm systems and affects the ionosphere. It's actually backwards of what is really going on, where the ionospheric, the up in the very top of the atmosphere where the ionosphere resides, that is affecting the lower weather systems, the weather systems down at the surface of the Earth, not vice versa. I'm sure there's some feedback mechanisms in there, but it's not like the lower tropical or thunderstorms, tropical storms, whatever, are at the surface of the Earth are affecting the ionosphere. They have it exactly backwards. So, at any rate, but imagine the ancients seeing these huge, large comets and then writing for future generations, telling them, warning them. This brings up an interesting topic. A friend of mine called the other day and said that he was at a party, and there was a woman there from Peru who had grown up with the native Indians in Peru, and both her parents spoke the native dialect that the Indians still spoke, which was basically the Inca India dialect, which still continues on today. There are still people in Peru who speak that. So, at any rate, being a good fan and friend, and who is very familiar with my work, she's talking to him and telling him about the culture and things like that. And so, of course, he drops the bombshell. He says, what about the comets? She goes, oh, the comets, yes, those are bad. Those are the bad, you know, the things that really cause disaster. So now here's a woman who had no preconceived notion, who only knew from what she had learned as a child through the language of the Peruvian Incas, the Indian language that still exists today. And when he asked the question, what about the comets, she immediately recognized that, yes, the comets are the dangerous things that really affect Earth. Yet modern science is still running around pretending like comets are little dirty snowballs and have no effect on Earth at all, unless they occasionally, once every gazillion years, one crashes into Earth. But it's only a little effect. And actually, as I said a couple weeks ago, now it's very clear that they have very much overestimated the worldwide damage that would be caused by some object coming in and crashing into Earth. The very much overestimated. Remember, I gave a story about the dinosaurs and how the dinosaurs, the story for many decades now, since the 80s, was that the dinosaurs died from an impact of an asteroid or comet on Earth, and they thought they had identified it as this crater, partially on land and partially in the ocean off the Yucatan Peninsula in southeastern Mexico. But now scientists have discovered that the 52 major species which existed prior to that impact also existed after the impact right in the localized area there. So the idea that the dinosaurs died from an impact from a comet, not only is that not true, but the dinosaurs and animals that lived in that area were not even driven into extinction. So once again, when you look at the mass extinction events, the dinosaur event, or the mastodon woolly mammoth event, which brought about the last ice age and the Holocene period when it changed over and we began the Great Glaciation that we're just getting out of now. When that happened, many other things happened. And just an asteroid colliding into Earth doesn't account for mountain building, for the change in coastlines all over the Earth, does not account for the change in the poles or the great melting of glaciated regions. It doesn't account for any of these. Yet Scientists, once they get something and it's kind of given that rubber stamp of approval, then you're dealing with something that, as I said, can you imagine? Here's two decades science has been reproducing this concept, the dinosaurs dying by the asteroid, newspapers, Discovery Channel events. I'm sure National Geographic has probably done a couple special articles on it with animation and on and on. Not even true. Not even a shred of truth in it. Yet it's been in the public, dominated the public information on the demise of the dinosaurs for two decades. Not even true. Not a shred of truth to it. So you can see what you're dealing with, or what I deal with when I go to these scientific meetings. Scientists are creeping along, discovering little bits and pieces of this, yet not understanding the big picture, not understanding the major causal effects, even of our own Earth weather. How can they predict climate change, which is a long global change in weather and the variability of the temperature and all of the conditions on Earth? How can they even pretend to predict that when they can't even predict the weather out a couple of days? It's a real contradiction in terms. So, and of course, as this goes along with the same concept, that they don't have the basic fundamental principles down, so how can they even begin to predict the weather, let alone climatology? Of course, the greenhouse effect, I'm sorry, I just had something pop up on my screen here. How can they predict the weather when they don't know what causes the weather? Let me go into my list here. Let's talk about Saturn. Now, this past week, there was quite a bit of discussion on the planet Saturn. Dust around the moons of Saturn. Dust tails, so to speak. Well, gee, isn't that kind of like a comet? Why would you expect the dust tail around a moon of Saturn? Well, if it's like a comet, then that's not too hard to understand. What about the ionization in Saturn's rings? Where does that come from? Well, once again, you're dealing with the issue of Saturn discharging the solar capacitor. There are currents of material flowing around Saturn. Where does that come from? Of course, that comes from the issue of Saturn being just like a comet. And these now have been measured. They've got great data with the Cassini mission to Saturn, but it is also being totally misinterpreted by the scientists. They have good data, bad theories. Let's put it that way. Great spacecraft that are taking the data, transmitting it back to Earth, but bad theories to interpret it. So I go down one after the other and I look at these posters, and it's just hard to even relate to these scientists because they're so misguided with respect to the theories that are coming along. So Saturn in the news, very much a current topic because of the Cassini results. And once again, good data, bad theories. Let me go to, what about our good friend Planet X? I know that's something that always raises people's ears. And remember what I've said before, there is not just one Planet X. It kind of drives me crazy. Sometimes people go, well, where's that Planet X thing? What do you know about it? When's it going to be here? And the real answer is that there are many, many Planet X objects. And this one they call Nibiru, how would you relate something that came into the solar system with Nibiru? How would you identify it? What's the identifying features? We've seen quite a few pretty good-sized comets come into the solar system. But how would you say, well, that's not Nibiru? You know, what's your identifying criteria? And I don't think the ancients left us with enough information. There's that the group that believed that Nibiru is on a 3,600-year orbit. Well, it would have been here and gone by now. 3,600 years has come and gone since the last event. So it's not. And by the way, the thing that happened about 3,600 years ago, as far as I can reckon, and this is all speculative, but it seems like the most likely answer, is that that was the planet Venus. And if it became the planet Venus, then it's not going to come back into the solar system, is it? Because it's already orbiting the sun. It's been captured. It became a planet. And that's where it is. And it's not out there to come back in again. So the Nibiru, I've always estimated that Venus, the chunk of matter that became the planet, first the comet Venus and then the planet Venus, was a companion to Nibiru. And just like Hale-Bopp, and that would put the period of Nibiru back about 4,250 years, maybe a little bit more. And it could have been even more than that. It's hard to say because you don't know what was going on back then, what kind of orbits changed, did they increase, did they decrease? It's just really hard to say. We don't have what you would call good data. You don't have orbital data that you could use to make estimates. Where does it, which portion of the solar system is it coming into? The space is a big place out there. We have 360 degrees in all directions. Where would it possibly come from? And so there are many issues when you talk about Planet X. There are no simple answers, let's put it that way. Could it totally destroy Earth? Yes. Could it suck our atmosphere off like something did to Mars a few thousand years ago? Yes. Could it be just a minor event? Yes. All of those are hypothetical possibilities, but there's no way of saying this is what's going to happen or we're going to have a pole change. It's just unbelievable the amount of garbage that has come out from people that have no clue what they're talking about regarding the topic of Planet X. And then, of course, you have the standard science community that's trying to make the idea ridiculous while at the same time they are discovering them by the dozens and dozens and dozens out there. And, of course, like I said, that's what the Hubble Space Telescope is all about, the new camera. The point is they want to look for these objects, but they're not going to tell you about it. So, once again, it's great that the astronauts went up there and did a 5-day spacewalk to fix the Hubble Space Telescope. But the reality is, if something big happens out there, they're not going to give that information to you, the public. So that's kind of a summary on Planet X. I haven't talked about the water filters for a while. Last week, I just quickly mentioned the plastic water filter. I'll just give a quick summary of that. It's $219, 3-gallon capacity. It's the tank on top. Comes with 5 Dalton Super Sterisol 7-inch candles, which are the filter elements. Those are the 3-part filter elements. And the $219 includes shipping. And this unit is capable of filtering up to 50 gallons per day. If you used all 5 filter elements and just kept pouring water in it, you would be able to maintain a capacity of 50 gallons per day with that unit. But most people just use one of the filter elements and then they got 4 spares. In fact, it's really a good deal because it's almost worth just the filter elements themselves are worth that. So it's almost like you're getting the plastic containers for free. And they're the same filter elements that you would use in your standard stainless steel Dalton, which costs $319, just a little bit smaller capacity. But at any rate, it's made out of HDPE, high-density polyethylene plastic, food-grade plastic, so it's not going to leach into your water supply. There's no dioxin, fear of dioxins getting into your water supply. So anyway, just quickly, it's $219, JMCC. Here's the address. Just write check or money order to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. Once again, that's JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. Or go to the webpage, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. Once again, that address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. And $219 for the high-density polyethylene plastic Dalton water filter with five of the 7-inch Dalton 3-part candles, filter elements capable of filtering up to 50 gallons of water per day. A lot of people take those camping or up to the cabin or have it as a spare. And, of course, the main stainless steel unit is $319. That also includes shipping. And the stainless steel one, also you get the free Kato WRX 911 radio, emergency radio, which is a great radio. You can listen to this show on it, listen to all of the shortwave bands, and real high quality for a little radio. Okay, just going to cap off this show on science of the solar system. Let's imagine, let's be a oxygen molecule and a hydrogen molecule out in the far reaches of outer space. And all of a sudden Earth comes along, the Earth passes between the Sun and these two atoms, basically, that are floating around in outer space. All of a sudden they feel a little bit of a tug with all of their friend atoms that are around them in the plasma of outer space, out on the backside of Earth in outer space, and they all of a sudden feel a tug, an electrical tug, and they start migrating towards Earth. As they get closer, they bump into each other, they form water, and that's where the water comes from that falls down into our storm system. So it's just the same exact process as a comet. And so once again, understanding comets is essential to understanding the entire interaction of the solar system. Earth weather, solar weather, all of these are related. Let me see if there's any other points I can make here. Oh, yeah, I think this is what I'm going to end with. That the Earth has changed many times. The atmosphere we have today is not the same atmosphere we had when the dinosaurs were here. In fact, it would be very difficult to estimate what the real atmosphere was like when the dinosaurs were around, or even when the mastodons were here. It's hard to imagine exactly what our atmosphere was like. We know there was less water on Earth at the time. We had a tremendous flood. The Noah's flood was a portion of the comet tail flooding into Earth's atmosphere, the hydrocarbons coming in, the rain of oil and naphtha. So all of these effects drastically affecting Earth and almost killing off the Earth population. So, by a major cometary encounter. At any rate, I'm just about out of time here. Next week, I'll continue with some new science topics, but at any rate, Jim McCanny here. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.